Okay, welcome everyone to and thank you for coming to this early session on the last day of the conference. We've all commented on the size of the crowd and how thankful we are for it. Today you are in the session, the panel session, The Stories Institutions Tell. And again, thank you for coming. And of course, as is our custom, it seems, thank you for White Fox Rare Books and Antiques for sponsoring this session. I've heard several people mention that every session has been sponsored, and that's no small feat, having spent a little time in the fundraising world before my library career. I have nothing but sympathy for the people who do this. Anyway, my name is Greg Schmidt. I am the librarian at Auburn University, and for those of you who don't know, that's a college in Alabama, or a university in Alabama. This is my first RBMS where I'm neither presenting nor doing a poster session. So this is kind of neat. And you know, to pay attention and not worry about what's coming next. Well, I do worry about it. But anyway, you know, being surrounded by this many, you know, thoughtful and engaged colleagues is kind of exhilarating and intimidating. And as a librarian from a deep South state and a state institution, when I saw the descriptions for this particular session, I asked to moderate it. It speaks to me as a special collections librarian, my mission, and my you know, sense of what's right as a professional. I am a furious note taker and a reluctant question asker, so we will be saving the questions until the end, and our speakers will go in the order they are in the program. Well, let's start what we've come into the room to do. I will introduce our speakers to you. Lisa Conathan is the head of special collections at Williams College, where she oversees the Chapin Library of Rare Books and College Archives. Prior to joining Williams, she held various positions in the Beinecke Rare Book and Manuscript Library, Yale University. Lisa holds a PhD in historical linguistics from the University of California, Berkeley, and an MLS from the University of Maryland. Erica Gorder is the interim university archivist at Rutgers University. She has been at Rutgers since 1997 and started off as the first archivist at the Institute of Jazz Studies. And Jillian Cuellar is the co-head of collection management at UCLA Library Special Collections. She provides oversight for digital archives, digital projects, and technologies that support collection management. She also oversees the Center for Primary Research and Training, a graduate student engagement program that uses creative methods to introduce students to archives and special collections. Previously, she worked as an archivist at New York University, Columbia University, and Parsons, the New School of Design. Please join me in welcoming our speakers, and I look forward to it. I hope you do too.
Thank you, Greg, and thank you all for joining us today. I was inspired, as many of you were, by Michaela Bly's encouragement to show, don't tell. And so I prepared remarks and I printed them out, and then this morning I went through and I was scribbling out all the parts where I was telling and not showing, and furiously writing in more showing, so you can let me know how it turned out. I wanted to take a cue from Melissa Hubbard's welcome at the beginning of the conference and acknowledge our indigenous hosts, the Iowa and Illini Siouan people who were joined by the Meskwaki as colonial migrants in this area in which we're meeting today. They have a long history here that is ongoing. The story I'll tell you today starts 25 years ago when I arrived on the campus of Dartmouth College as a first-year student. I started college in the midst of a decades-long debate about a piece of public art depicting the founder of the college, Eliezer Wheelock, a Yale-educated minister of the Great Awakening, establishing the college in 1769 as a Native American mission school. The mural is based on a drinking song by Richard Hovey, an esteemed Dartmouth alum, and it depicts Wheelock parading into the wilderness, accompanied not only by printings of the foundational texts of Western civilization, here seen in the form of a Gradus ad Parnassum, but also by 500 barrels of New England rum. The Hovey murals, completed in 1939, can only be understood in relationship to another work of public art at Dartmouth College, the Jose Clemente Orozco murals, completed in 1934. Hovey and Orozco faced off across campus in the culture wars of the 1930s, one presenting a radically leftist and pro-indigenous view of history, the other a deeply homosocial and anti-intellectual representation of the men of Dartmouth, who celebrated and satirized colonial values in the Hovey murals. It wasn't until recently, oh, by the way, I worked in this reserve corridor where these murals were as an undergraduate, so I spent many, many hours in the presence of these images. They were very formative for me. It wasn't until recently that circumstances led me to research the Hovey mural and to look closely at photographs of it for the first time. In the 1990s, the mural was covered, and I never saw it. The Hovey murals exist in the context of a long and complex relationship between Dartmouth and its native students. In the 1990s, as now, the college exhibited a deep commitment to the education of Native Americans that reflects the particular evangelical circumstances of its founding and a 20th century reconfiguration of this commitment in light of the civil rights movement. Since 1970, Dartmouth has graduated more Native American students than all other Ivy League institutions combined. The Hovey murals are but one aspect of an institutional landscape in which Native Americans figure prominently, notably evoking alumni reverence and nostalgia for the institution. The murals now reside in the college's art museum and have been the subject of intense discourse and scholarly inquiry, including a book-length treatment edited by Dartmouth faculty. 24 years later, I started a new job at Williams College, a small New England liberal arts school with no history of significant engagement with Native people. In 2015, a campus public space was reopened after significant renovations. With the renovation came renewed attention to an interior mural painted in 1942 by Stanley Rowland, depicting the founder of the college, Ephraim Williams, and Hendrick Peters Teyanaguin, a Mohawk chief who perished with Williams in 1755 and what we have come to call the French and Indian War. The mural depicts several Mohawk and English soldiers strategizing before the final battle of Lake George. I was deeply affected by the recurrence of another Indian mural controversy, separated from the earlier one by decades in which frank and contested dialogue about cultural representation has become mainstream in the academy. The Williams campus community examined and criticized the mural for its depiction of Hendrick Peters Teyanaguin and his relationship to Colonel Williams. The local conversation was not an isolated incident in a year that saw campuses across the nation grappling with their histories and representation of minority groups in public art, memorials, or in naming of campus buildings. And I'm sure everyone in the audience has encountered similar incidents in your home institutions or nearby ones. Let's place the Hovey murals and the Williams mural side by side. So the one from Williams isn't too bad, right? It doesn't show drunk Indians holding a book upside down. It doesn't show creepily scatological drinking binges reminiscent of the worst of fraternity hazing rituals. It shows Indian men in cooperation with colonists on equal footing as they plan a battle. The intention is to honor the relationship between a revered Mohawk leader and an English colonist who willed a portion of his vast estate to found what would eventually become Williams College. Considering how bad it could have been, why might anyone object to the log mural? The objections on campus raised several points. First, it's the only public acknowledgement of Native people on campus. There's no active Native student organization. There are no monuments to Native people. There are no buildings named after the local Mohican tribe. There's no Native studies program, although there are periodic course offerings. The student body is diverse in terms of socioeconomic status, race, and national origin, but it has a very small population of Native students. The mural stands alone, representing Williams College's public statements on Native culture. Second, we might wonder whether the relationship depicted, one in which two military equals are strategizing before a battle, is historically accurate. Did Hendrick and Ephraim strategize together? Did they come up with a specific plan of attack for the Battle of Lake George together? The men were caught in an ambush that day, resulting in both of their deaths. Are Hendrik and Ephraim equally to blame for that failure? Third, many people were confused by a fuzzy understanding of who the local Native Americans are. Teanaguin is Mohawk, and the people depicted here are Mohawk, but the local tribe in Williamstown is Mohican. So where are the Mohicans? Why was Ephraim collaborating with Mohawks and not Mohicans? Finally, it can get pretty chilly in the Berkshires in September, and so why are the Indians so scantily dressed? You can see, we have people who are half naked there. This is a very often encountered trope of the depiction of Native people, that they have fewer clothes on than the white people in the same view. You see this in the Hovey mural. You also see this in the depiction of enslaved people. If you look at the Lincoln Emancipation Monument, that's an example of a slave with no clothes on. A draft of the painting even shows that when the painting was originally drafted, the Indians had more clothes on, and they lost some of their clothing on the way. And at least Hendrik has a blanket, but contemporary depictions of Hendrik Peters Teanaguin show that he typically dressed in an English fashion. So this conception of him dressing in this way was really a fantasy. Amid renewed attention to the log mural, Williams College President Adam Falk established a committee on campus space and institutional history to provide recommendations regarding the fate of the mural and to similarly look at other public monuments and works of art on campus. During the committee's deliberation, the mural was covered from public view, reminiscent of Dartmouth strategy decades earlier. The committee recommended that the mural be uncovered and remain on view, but that the college provide more context to the work of art and to continue to examine Williams' institutional history. Context and history. I was no longer a clueless and ineffectual undergrad, but I am now an adept department head with a capacity and authority to do this. So I began to work on an exhibit, placing the mural at the center of its intellectual organization. This was, of course, an act of hubris, joining an institution and then presuming to teach it something about its history when many of my colleagues have been working there since I was in diapers. But I did have a lesson to impart. The lesson began in the 18th century when the Ephraim Williams family were active participants in an intentional colonization project to Christianize local Mohican Indians and introduce them to English lifeways in the Stockbridge Mission. Ephraim felt responsible for the Mohicans, and in an early draft of his will, he provided an annual sum for promoting and propagating Christian knowledge amongst the Indians at Stockbridge. Ephraim's legacy was not far from his mind on the day depicted in the mural. Scarcely more than a month earlier, he had rewritten that will. He chose to instead designate his legacy for newly colonized land in a remote corner of Massachusetts. The town was West Hoosick, though it would later be known as Williamstown. When the real estate speculator Ephraim Williams revised his will a month before he died, he donated land for the purpose of founding a free school on the condition that the school and the town be named after him. When he removed the stipulation that the school would serve Indian people, he effectively wrote Native Americans out of his will. We can imagine an alternative history of Williams College, in which, like Dartmouth, it was founded as an Indian mission school. While the life of Ephraim Williams, a wealthy colonist, is well documented, I found frustrating gaps in our historic documentation of Teanaguin. There's no evidence that he was literate. There's no writings of his that survive. He signed his name with a stylized initials, HP, reflecting his English name. We have only tantalizingly incomplete references to his thoughts, including most significantly transcripts of his speeches to the Albany Congress of 1754, a monumental event in colonial history. It's from this speech that the title of the exhibit and my talk are derived. Hendrik engaging in a dialogue with James DeLancey, governor of the province of New York, regarding responses to disputes over colonial occupation of Mohawk land, states, "We are much obliged to the governor for his promise to direct the commissioners of Indian affairs to take due notice of us for the future. that he will try them of 1 year longer and for giving us leave to acquaint the government if they do not treat us as brethren. The statement is ambiguous. Is Hendrik a forceful belligerent, asserting a threat to the governor couched in diplomatic language? Is he a compliant sympathizer with the government of Provincial New York? What was his view of the complainants who claim Mohawk land? A small clue to Hendrik's opinions and influences is found in a letter from 1746, 8 years before he addressed the Albany Congress and 9 years before his death. Aaron Stevens, an interpreter of Mohawk and English heritage, writes to the governor of New York, George Clinton, regarding strategy for enlisting the aid of Mohawks in the war against the French. Stevens refers to the opinion of Hendrik as significant in swaying the Mohawks to the English side. Secondary clues, such as are contained in this letter, provide scarce contemporary evidence of Hendrik's belief, significance, and his significance as conveyed by others. The exhibit also examined the documentation and depiction of Native people in library collections. As might be expected in a significant collection of Americana, Native Americans play a foundational role in our rare book library. The Chapin Library was founded in 1923 when Alfred Clark Chapin donated his rare book collection to support the college curriculum. His intention to incorporate rare books into the undergraduate curriculum was progressive, possibly radical at the time. What was the book that inspired Mr. Chapin to build a collection that would benefit William students by bringing them into intimate contact with books of significance? What was the first book he purchased in 1915 when he was inspired to endow a library at Williams? Any guesses? The Eliot Bible, the first Bible printed in what is now the United States, a monumental work entirely in the Massachusetts English language. The labor, culture, and significance of Native people are therefore at the very cornerstone of the Chapin Rare Book Library. While Native students and faculty are poorly represented at Williams, cultural representations are found throughout college history and are documented in the archives, including incidents of playing Indian, the concept articulated by historian Philip DeLoria as crucial to American cultural identity from the Boston Tea Party to today's Washington NFL football team. We see freshmen parading in Indian costume in the 1920s, in one instance pairing founder Ephraim with an Indian maiden. And we also see the national tabloid press sensationalizing a 1939 prank in which students commemorated an Indian raid on Fort Massachusetts by emphasizing the aspects of Indian play. In the recent academic year, we had the opportunity to work intensively with two courses that directly addressed institutional history. These courses allowed us to delve into the issues around cultural representation and introduce students to primary source research in direct support of critical inquiry. The toughest challenge we faced was student frustration with historic absence. When researching the story of Williams and Native Americans, the students always wanted documents created by Native people, showing the Native perspective. We don't always have those documents, and in many cases, they simply don't exist. While students are often reluctant to work with colonial documents, we push them to critically engage the material in order to question their authority and discover counter-narratives. And here I did want to make a plug for a book by Marissa Fuentes called Dispossessed Lives. And when we were addressing this issue of historic absence, the introduction to her book, which directly addresses these issues of what it's like to be a historian when you're working in an area that the documentation doesn't exist, is really useful. It's a great chapter. It's a brief chapter to assign to students when you're doing research education with them. Several papers from these courses are now available on our new student scholarship site in our Islandora digital repository. And when we publish student work, we're asking students to write for a public audience, and it brings a new dynamic to the seminar paper. The audience is no longer just the instructor. By highlighting student scholarship, we're also inviting students to lead the way in their investigations and critiques of the institution's history. Just a few months ago, there was a second campus incident involving the public representation of a historicized Native man, a theater poster for a local production of the play August, Osage County. The poster features a 19th century photograph of a Native man with a tattered American flag superimposed. The individual in the poster is not identified. He's a generic Indian man evoking the strength, silence, and nostalgia of a romanticized 19th century. He's not a person, he's a mood, a teaser to entice potential theatergoers. Thanks to some savvy research by a Williams student, we know that the photograph depicts Chief Littlehead of the Crow tribe of Wyoming and Montana, photographed by Frank J. Haynes in the 1880s. The photographer Haynes produced promotional images for the Northern Pacific Railroad and became famous for his early images of Yellowstone National Park, the purpose of which was to attract tourists and settlers who would make use of new rail lines. The Indians he photographed were part of the enticement. Haynes' project to present Indians as tourist attractions in order to get Euro-Americans to use a new system of transit presages early 20th century tourist ephemera, enticing motorists onto the new Mohawk Trail, which connects Greenfield, Massachusetts with Albany, New York, and runs directly through Williamstown. Images such as this situated the highway in a narrative progressing from Indian wilderness to modern Anglo-American society, in which wilderness is enjoyed as a tourist experience. The use of ahistoric native people as enticements to leisure is a practice with a long American history. Students also objected to the dissonance between the visual content of the poster and the content of the play. The play is a family-based dark comedy that features one native character, Jana, a young housekeeper who is both silent and subservient. The contrast between the strong male Crow Indian chief and a marginalized housekeeper struck the students as inappropriate. This is actually an image from a different production of the play, but I thought it showed Jana in an interesting way. The recurrence of conversations around representation of Native people reminds us that our work in examining cultural representation is ongoing. The poster was another opportunity to engage in dialogue about nativeness and absence on campus, and we did so in a public forum. Future topics of conversation have already been identified, including a monument to the foundation of the American evangelical movement, a painting depicting the theater as Commedia dell'arte by the Dutch artist Herman Rossi. When acting as curators, archivists, and interlocutors in relation to these monuments, we strive to catalyze conversation and provide context to challenging topics while also promoting an inclusive environment, which necessarily means challenging historical practice of cultural marginalization. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. I hope everybody's been enjoying Iowa City. It happens to be my hometown. So it's really kind of fun and a little strange to be talking about Rutgers University in Iowa. But I'm here to speak about archivists and institutional narratives, author, translator, and muse. As long as I can remember, and actually I want to test this, as long as I can remember, much ink has been spilled over what it means to be an archivist. Distilled to a binary situation, the roles are usually expressed as historian versus information professional. Like Gandalf or the Paper Pushers of Brazil, the movie. But a close look at the archival profession reveals many roles, or stereotypes, depending on how you look at it. Are we historians or custodians? Technocrats or walking encyclopedia, servant or scholar, objective bystander or social justice warrior, perhaps a little bit of all. For the institutional archivist, we're often required to be our organization's historian, and we do shape the narratives of our institutions. Fulfilling administrative needs is also a major aspect of what we do. From the increasingly popular corporate model perspective, public relations and branding is enhanced by recounting history and heritage iconography. Commemorative events like anniversaries embody the multiple roles and sometimes competing demands on the archives. Today, I'd like to highlight several identities that have emerged for me in the past year working on a commemorative event and examine how archivists participate in institutional storytelling. So this is the commemorative event that I worked on, the Rutgers 250th anniversary. I want to back up a little bit by saying my perspective is that each historian, and I use the term broadly, is a storyteller, plucking bits and details, sometimes hidden, out of a large body of records, or in some instances, reading the absence of records, who transforms analysis of evidence into narrative and brings the past to life for students, scholars, and the general public alike. Conveying history through narrative, I think, is a central element of public history. And doing institutional history, I think, is public history. Within the larger society, institutions of higher education, for example, are a distinctive subculture with our own social structure, governance, cultural practices, rituals, shaping the identity of its students and faculty. As a place, too, college campuses forge personal identities. Members of this community have a shared experience with the place over time. And I think institutions of higher education are perhaps unique in their ability to connect the past, present, and future. Is that my mic going crazy there? Colleges and universities partly rely on memory to ensure their perpetuation and sustainability. Cultural heritage is shaped through both official commemorations, like the Rutgers 250, and vernacular memory, the institution's public history. So as you see here, Rutgers 250, was the big celebration that the University Archives was involved with for an entire year, well before that. A shameless plug, Rutgers is the eighth oldest institution of higher education in the United States. In 2013, the 250 committee was formed, and we knew that the archives would be central and pivotal to the planning of the year-long celebration. And we were part of the actual larger 250 committee. And that's Tom Frusciano, the university archivist, and myself at one of the events with fireworks, and it was very fun. That was towards the end, so we were incredibly happy that it was all over. the preparation for the 250 anniversary year involved a dizzying array of committees, spin-offs, events, and products. And yes, products. These included several books, a commemorative history, like a coffee table book, and a scholarly history of the university from 1945 to the present. I'll talk more about that later. A major exhibition in special collections and university archives galleries, which I curated. We had an app. We had a congressional reception at the U.S. Botanical Gardens. That was an awful lot of fun. And we have what I call the more inclusive or diverse activities, responses to the celebration, such as Black on the Banks and Latinos at Rutgers. And finally, the Committee on Slavery and Disenfranchised Populations in Rutgers History, which has become known as the Scarlet and Black Project. And this is the book that came out of that project, and of course I'll talk in great detail about that a little bit later. So the anniversary portrait, which I call the official narrative. It's a highly illustrated coffee book. The chapters were thematic rather than a continuous narrative. There were seven major authors and many minor authors writing smaller sidebars, and there were multiple editors. So as archivists, this was a challenge for us, dealing with a lot of different people asking us for things. And one of the first controversies, just from a narrative perspective, was the chunking out of essays. There were longer essays, and the editors chunked them out into small pieces and sidebars. This isn't a bad thing, but the result was at times a confusing and seemingly random format. It reflected truthfully the challenge of telling such a long story in its complexity while attempting to be inclusive, accurate, and celebratory. Were the smaller pieces representative or objective? Could there be any objectivity telling this story? Perhaps the multitude of short stories added a more nuanced and diverse snapshot of the school. As you might expect, there were also questions and controversies over breadth versus depth, and does college pride preclude critical analysis? Well, we didn't want to be too critical. We were celebrating this institution. The role in the book of the archivist perspective was we were authors first and foremost. Let's see here. That's working. Oh, that's me. So Tom Frusciano wrote the historical chapter, and I wrote an essay on concerts, which is one of my favorite areas when I talk about the history. So there's Devo and Bo Diddley. This was inspired. I had done an exhibit on concerts at Rutgers a few years before. I got another shameless plug, Linda Ronstadt and the Clash. And she's wearing a Rutgers cheerleaders uniform there too. But this is a really, it reinforces our role as historians of our own institutions, and as such, we're vested with some authority. As an aside, I'm still to this day a little bit surprised at how few of the contributing authors actually came to the archives to do research. Nevertheless, we were called upon to act as researchers, fact checkers, and reviewers of their work. We also provided hundreds of images, including some of these. It was primarily a picture book, so we had to use images to tell the story. Again, our role as researchers for the authors and editors meant we had little input about the contents and topics of the stories. We had little opportunity to provide unusual, infrequently used photographs or alternate stories, with the exception of what I inserted there. Really, instead, there were times that the project felt kind of like a rehash of the same images and words. You know, again, this was really the commemorative, the celebratory product that had come out. Last but not least, we were members of the editorial group for photographs. And as I look back on this, my stomach knots up a little bit, remembering the long, long hours, long days, long meetings to debate the merits of images and interpreting mammoth spreadsheets that the editors of the book gave us. This is one of the grids. Oh, we would get these daily. People would ask questions about, can't you find anything more interesting to represent this topic? And then we'd scramble around trying to find an image that, you know, illustrated something better. But during one of our editorial meetings, questions about representing the Women's College arose. One person commented that all the photographs were, and I quote, "women looking silly." Good point, which we grappled with as we worked with the exhibition. So the mermaids on the left are the ones that looked silly, and then these are the more studious images of the ladies in the library. Which brings me to Rutgers Through the Centuries, 250 years of treasures from the archives, which was, I think, the archivist narrative. Okay, this was the exhibition that we did. To condense such a long story into 22 exhibit cases obviously is a challenge. You have to select based on what extant records you have, but on top of that, what are treasures or iconic? And the 250 office really wanted us to use the word treasures, which we normally wouldn't have used. The original idea pitched by the 250 office was to have an exhibit called 250 Objects That Made Rutgers. An interesting idea, but ultimately unworkable. Archival records are often not obvious as standalone symbols. Even if there were canonical objects, would they be extant anyways? Sure, there was some kind of writing implement used to sign the charter, but what are the chances that such a thing survived? And so we were asked questions, hey, do you have the pen that signed the charter? We're like, no, it didn't survive, sorry. So instead, the archives took this as our opportunity to let loose. We used objects to narrate in a compelling and I think visually pleasing way. There's just some examples of our exhibition. We used objects to narrate. Individual items might not directly represent an idea, but in assemblage, they create a vignette, recreating an environment by using records, photographs, art ephemeras, what we were really aiming for. The exhibition was an opportunity for us to display the treasures, but also the other stuff that doesn't really see the light of day. We preserve these things because they have a value, but perhaps have a more obscure utility for traditional research. The material culture of everyday life, the outliers, the weirdos, and the lone wolves that inhabit the archives. And so in one of these pictures you can see, you can't really see it, but you know, like there's the, I want to say blowhorn, now I'm completely, the oh golly, what's it called? Okay, never mind, I'll move on. There's a little statue of Mr. Magoo. He's a Rutgers graduate, by the way. You know, microscopes that we have, scientific implements, things that we have in the archives that we want to show. We tried to kind of recreate what a 1850s student desk might look like. We just happened to have the gas oil lamp and some of the writings of one of our students, Daniel Rapalsch, class of 1850, just to try to convey, and we don't ever use these, so it was really a great opportunity for us to. And just here's some more, you know, examples of our exhibit. And you know, this was really, for us, an adventure of discovery. It was a time for us as archivists to delve more deeply into our collections and to investigate topics that had perhaps long eluded us, but that we never had a chance to research fully. So indeed, you know, sometimes, especially in the age of MPLP, we don't have the luxury to get to know our collections. So for instance, what do we have on the land grant designation? We know what happened, we have this document in the Board of Trustees records, but has anybody really looked at the personal papers at some of the major players? Has anyone actually investigated what parcel of land our scrip was for? Who sold it? What Native American tribe was robbed of it? We didn't find much, unfortunately, but it really amplifies the fact that we really did have a good deal of latitude and freedom to show multiple facets of the university and to be a little bit critical. In a sense, we didn't have to be uniformly representative. For good or ill, this is exactly what reveals the archivist's personal subjectivity. So I'll talk about this. So for my part, you know, I think student life is historically important and engaging, but that might not be shared by others. I think that the audience finds stories more compelling if they're relatable. So for example, amongst the earliest founding documents, which you can see here in this case, which I think are kind of dry and boring, we have a letter that we also recently had excavated because we got a chance to do some deep research. We found a letter from Theodore Frelinghuysen to his wife, Elizabeth. He had made the journey to the Netherlands to make a case for founding the college. And in his letter he says, "And therefore, my dear, think not that I am wanting in my love for you. It is very hard for me to be so long absent from you. Kiss for me, my dear babe. Be well contented, and let our dear babe be a comfort to you, and God bless it." This heartwarming and heartbreaking letter, knowing that he will perish on the journey home, ultimately reminds us that history is the story of people just like us. Relatability, and dare I say fun, came out of our out in our display of student life and culture. We emphasized this outside of the boundaries of our main galleries, and throughout other library spaces, drawing the viewer in. So we did a lot of blow-ups. We did student life blow-ups that we distributed throughout the library, and it was really popular, and it did bring students into the archives to look at our larger exhibit, to ask us questions. But this also brings me to the silly women. Okay, there they are again at the Women's College. The role of the archivist as translator involves sifting through the historic record, seeing evidence as it exists, and making it comprehensible. So as we reviewed scores of photos, it seems as if we kept coming across evidence of women being creative and having fun. The clubs and special events, performances, art exhibits, the mermaids, as you saw before, dances, really formed the culture of the college. Let's see if this is not working. There we go. And there's one of the dances. Some of the dances, women were attended in drag, so those are all ladies. And they did this regularly. But as I mentioned earlier, one of the book editors questioned the photo options. Why are we only seeing pictures of women looking silly? Don't we have any other shots of them being studious? It's a college. We're about education. So of course, the history of higher learning must address the very significant historic development of women's access to education, and conveying this by portraying women engaged in activities that are studious. And to be sure, we use these images in the book and the exhibit, women in libraries, in laboratories, and in the classroom. On the other hand, from a marketing and PR standpoint, the publishers and editors also desired images that weren't boring, and they liked these images. Or for that matter, why did we have so many black and white images? Don't we have more color photographs? But there's an historical and cultural significance that we found a lot of fun and diverse activities represented. The cultural expressions of women in college were created autonomously. The photos exist because the women chose to create and publish those images. It's a self-representation and shows a culture, one that's coincidentally not mirrored in the colleges for men. Contrasted with the representation of the men at Rutgers, I think that it's important to highlight the fact that the documentary record shows differences in the college landscape, as well as women celebrating the brave new world they were creating. So to wrap up talking about the exhibit, in the end, it demonstrates the importance of visual narrative that can be immersive and flexible. Giving gallery tours, of which we did many, allowed us to modify the narrative depending on the audience and really engage in a dialogue, the contours of which could change in any given circumstance. So finally, I'd like to talk about the Scarlet and Black Project, or what I call the uncovered narratives. In the Rutgers 250 celebration featured the expected commemorative events, but also provided a backdrop for more critical and inclusive examination of Rutgers's past. So just before the formal 250 launch, the symposium Black on the Banks welcomed Black alumni to speak about their experiences at Rutgers. Later in the cycle, the Latino and Caribbean Studies Department hosted a conference in celebration remembering the Rutgers Puerto Rican student movement of the 1970s, which was a part of a larger Latino memory project in which the University Archives is currently involved. If Black on the Banks was an unofficial opening to the Rutgers 250, then in many ways Scarlet and Black was the closer. And that's the website for our project, Scarlet and Black Project. So the slogan of the 250 was Rutgers, revolutionary for 250 years. It seemed to capture the Revolutionary War era founding of the college while celebrating the major accomplishments of its students, alumni, and faculty. Early in the celebration, however, the Rutgers community, particularly students, inspired by the Black Lives Matter movement, began to critique and interrogate the concept of revolutionary. The backdrop, of course, was Craig Wilder's Ebony and Ivy, and the investigation on the part of many of the colonial colleges of the role of slavery and institutionalized racism in their building and development. And there's Deborah Gray Wright. It was only natural, I think, that the inquiry into Rutgers and slavery was initiated. While the 250 attempted to be as inclusive as possible, the formation of the Committee on Enslaved and Disenfranchised Populations in Rutgers History on November 10, 2015, marked a true commitment. To attempt to ensure that the enslaved, the subaltern, the ignored, and the indeed erased people are recognized and heard, a full research agenda was necessary. We did not have the answers to the many questions that arose, so the university recognized that extensive archival inquiry was required to bring these histories to light. So Dr. White was the chair, and appointed chair of the Slavery Committee, and swiftly enlisted Professor Marisa Fuentes, who Lisa had mentioned before, to plan and shape the project. Dr. White and Fuentes, along with 17 graduate students in the history department, Professor Camilla Townsend, who's an historian of Native American history, New Brunswick Theological Seminary Professor of Church History, John Coakley, and the University Archives, Tom Frusciano, and myself, formed the research subcommittee. The goal of the research committee was to focus in several key areas, slaveholding in the early founders and trustees, the use of slaves in the construction of the college, slavery in the surrounding community of the city of New Brunswick and New Jersey, and the political economy and ideology of slavery. And the research was done by the graduate students who had broken off into groups. It quickly became clear that the committee would go beyond issuing a report. Instead, a larger historical narrative was desired. In fact, as the research unfolded and details emerged, the student and faculty intensely discussed the importance of narrativizing this history. And that's more of us here as one of our meetings. Throughout the year, the committee met roundtable style to discuss strategy, findings, and book logistics. So at the very earliest stages, the archives was really involved. We were called upon to provide guidance and direction. The students and faculty relied upon us for much of their work. They asked us about sources, about the early history of school, and we in turn illuminated potential paths of inquiry. Archivists were there at the beginning, and what developed was an invaluable and lasting partnership. And in some ways, research began with a two-line entry in the Old Queen's Building Construction Book of 1808 that recorded the use of Jacob Dunham's Negro. And this was really the aha moment that, yes, slaves did participate in constructing the college. I had recently discovered this entry working on the exhibit because we put this volume in our exhibition. And it really shows that clues, though they're hard to come by, as archivists, we reveal clues, and these are serendipitous because we're working with these collections and we can show the students places to look. And I think this sort of highlights archivists' role, going beyond just description of materials, going beyond the finding aid, and really interacting with researchers. So some of the challenges of the research and analysis were expected. It reflected, though, innovative ways historians must view the record and coax out those details of a story, grappling with the scarcity of sources and lack of direct evidence. So every scrap of information, every thread, every crumb is analyzed and used. A ledger entry here, a will abstract there, an oblique reference to Halfpenny Town in a diary. So to evoke these stories out of the disparate and scarce sources was the great accomplishment of the project, as much as was the not unexpected revelation that slavery did indeed underpin the founding of Queens College, which was what Rutgers was originally called, and also the region. So too was the fact that archivists really did work in close cooperation with the members of the committee, and it was an exchange. I think in some ways, archivists inspired the students, sprinkling some archivist magic fairy dust onto them as they transferred the historian back onto us. So writing Scarlet and Black, Volume 1, Slavery and Dispossession in Rutgers History, was the goal of this project. As members of the research committee, we also provided fact-checking. We read the essays, commented, gave feedback and citation assistance. And I know I'm probably going over time, but I really would like to read some of the chapters to you to give you an idea of really what came out of this research project. So one of the chapters is, I am old and weak, and you are young and strong, the intersecting histories of Rutgers University and the Lenni Lenape. That was the tribe in the region, the indigenous tribe in the region. Old Money, Rutgers University and the political economy of slavery in New Jersey. His name was Will, remembering enslaved individuals in Rutgers history. So we found out the name and the identity of the man who was used to construct the building. I hereby bequeath excavating the enslaved from the wills of the early leaders of Queens College. And I, poor slave, yet the precarity of black life in New Brunswick, 1766 to 1835. From the classroom to the American Colonization Society, making race at Rutgers. And finally, Rutgers, a land-grant college in Native American history. The committee, besides issuing this book, we did a symposium and we presented a report with recommendations. Among them were naming of buildings to honor the enslaved people who contributed to the growth of the college, continuing support for additional research, integration of these stories into all campus tours, among many others. Most of these recommendations have been accepted and implemented by the university. The research project has been extended for another 3 years. Yes, I'm so happy. With a postdoc position created and funding for the graduate student researchers to continue investigating the history of African Americans at Rutgers. 3 volumes of Scarlet and Black are envisioned. We're currently working on the second volume. So I'm a very sentimental person, and as I wrote this paper, I found myself getting a little bit verklempt, and I'm gonna get verklempt here. I think what we accomplished and how we did it was the epitome of what we can do as archivists. The archivist's dream, I called it. We work together as a team interacting with a record, and it's a shining example of trust and partnership. Through all the anniversary projects we demonstrated, another picture of the last picture of the group. Through all the anniversary projects, we demonstrated that we wear many hats: custodian, interpreter, author, creator, curator, muse. All these terms capture some facet of what we do, but I think another important word is trusted. In view of our work with many partners to uncover and illuminate the history of Rutgers and the diversity of our community and its heritage, I realized how intriguing and enlightening archives are to those who truly set out to find the stories within. Researchers of all levels and walks of life engaged in this work express an enthusiastic gratitude and awe working with archivists. We have sparked a flame and inspired them to take away a little bit of archivist with them. And finally, despite the fact that the emergent stories are not necessarily happy ones, there is a sense of joy in the discovery that which has so long been buried, new histories, new narratives that tell stories of individuals and communities, that in itself is a reckoning and a commemoration signifying community, commitment, justice, and trust. Thank you very much.
I was in high school once. One night I was at a coffee shop with my boyfriend and my best friend, and they started talking about their family history. My best friend said, "My great-grandfather was a very successful and wealthy banker." And my boyfriend said, "My ancestors were Hungarian royalty." And yeah, I know, saying that out loud, I'm as skeptical about the veracity of that claim as you may be, but at 17, it sounded impressive. What did not sound impressive to my 17-year-old mind was the fact that my great-grandparents and my grandparents and my parents as children were migrant workers, and day laborers and janitors and seamstresses and maids. So I didn't say anything at all. 13 years later, I'm sitting in a job interview trying to make the case for why I'm the most qualified person for the job. My one area of weakness that I can see is expertise in the collection subject area, which can generally be described as 20th century US social justice movements. My interviewer, an academic scholar in the field, seems skeptical that my professional experience as an archivist outweighs my lack of subject expertise. And so I mention that my great-grandparents and my grandparents and my parents as children were migrant workers in South Texas. My interviewer's eyes lit up. I've been thinking a lot recently about these two stories in juxtaposition to one another and the many other times in my life when I've either hid or highlighted my differences as it suits my interest. These thoughts have been prompted in part by recent literature that argues that diversity recruitment initiatives in libraries inherently require professionals from underrepresented ethnic and racial communities to assimilate to the cultural and social expectations established by our predominantly white middle class field, and that this required assimilation contributes to our failure to diversify our profession. While I have some qualms with some of the specific points of these arguments, overall I agree. I should know. I've been encouraged to assimilate my whole life, first and foremost by my parents. I can understand and appreciate why they encourage this when, as a child, you experience a culture that very clearly tells you that you don't belong. Then I can imagine you feel a strong obligation to protect your own children from such things. This expectation of assimilation has consequences that extend beyond the fact that our profession is no more diverse today than it was 10 or 20 years ago. It also results in a body of collections that do not always reflect marginalized communities with the nuance and depth they deserve. It means that communities whose record-keeping practices will not or cannot assimilate to our traditions are dissuaded from entering the archives. as creators, as users, or as practitioners. It means that while we may consider our collections representative of a local, national, or global cultural heritage, there is inevitably a dissonance between our understanding of how to represent marginalized communities and how they might choose to represent themselves outside the constructs of our profession. Are the materials we collect to represent marginalized communities merely telling the stories that we want to hear? If those communities were given real authority to create, maintain, and share their history, what stories would they choose to tell? My great-grandfather, Manuel Cuellar, was born in northwestern Mexico. He migrated to Texas by picking up work as a day laborer on ranches. He settled in what was then the southern outskirts of San Antonio and used his earnings to build this house himself to live in with my great-grandmother Dolores and their five children. He affixed his nameplate there under the archway like an artist's signature. The house was sold in 1989 after both of my grandparents died. It's still there, now well inside the city limits of San Antonio. My father's parents moved into a house two doors down when they got married in 1949. My grandmother, Ernestina, was a seamstress. Her Singer sewing machine, which first belonged to her mother, who was also a seamstress, sits now in her sewing room in San Antonio. My grandfather, Salvador, was a butcher. He had three fingertips missing to prove it. He gardened as a hobby, and in addition to the flowering trees and bushes that surrounded their house, he kept a large fig tree, which flourished in the Texas sun. When they sold their house and moved to the west side of San Antonio, he took a cutting of the fig tree and planted it in their new backyard. The longer I live outside of Texas, where I was born, the more I feel compelled to repeat certain facts and ideas to myself as a way of giving memories permanence. In recent years, I've become obsessed with the idea of my great-grandparents' house, searching the photo albums of my extended family for any shots of the interior or the backyard, both of which I remember vividly, but haven't seen since I was a child. My great-grandparents didn't have a legacy of wealth to pass on to their descendants, but they did have this house, and the idea that my great-grandfather built it himself seems particularly important. I worry about that house, wondering how long it will be there. I worry about my grandfather's fig tree, flourishing again in its new home. I worry about my grandmother's sewing machine, which no one but me seems to want, not knowing how I'll move it to Los Angeles, or how I'll keep it, along with the story that it tells. My maternal grandmother, Isabel Gonzalez, married my grandfather Pablo at 17 in a rural town in South Texas. After they married, a neighboring woman who was desperately in love with my grandfather asked a witch to put a spell on my grandmother. My grandmother fell gravely ill and slipped into a coma. At night, a lechuza would come to her window and howl and cackle at her until eventually my grandfather went to a curandera, a healer, who cast a counterspell, lifting the curse on my grandmother. As a child who loved ghost stories, I delighted in the idea of the lechuza, a demonic creature with the body of an owl and the head of a woman who sits outside of your window at the beckoning of a witch. As I got older, I saw this horrific figure appear in various mythologies called by different names, but I never saw it referred to as a lechuza. I later realized that the lechuza is part of a folktale specific to Mexican Americans living in South Texas, which further explains why when I Googled lechuza for the first time about 10 years ago, almost nothing came up except for information about owls, which is the literal English translation of the word. This family ghost story took a firm hold in my imagination as a child, giving me a glimpse of the way that Catholicism, Santeria, prayer, and the supernatural confronted each other in the daily lives of my ancestors. Despite holding a professional degree that is basically stamped with the words, "you can't Google everything," I was still surprised that Google doesn't know what a lechuza is. You get more hits if you Google it now, but not much. Later, I realized, of course this story doesn't live online. The stories of my grandmother, an illiterate Mexican-American woman who spoke Spanish and a little bit of broken English, are not told in the first person. If they are told at all, these stories are told by people like you and me. educated, middle-class professionals who acquire, preserve, and provide access to them. Nina Simone, the singer and musician, was born in this house in 1933 in Tryon, North Carolina. In February of this year, four black artists bought the house with the intention of preserving it as a way of honoring Simone's legacy. They worried that weather, gentrification, or a lack of community interest would eventually erode the house to nothing, and that this site, which serves as a portal to a woman who influenced so many, would be lost. They characterized the purchase as both a political and artistic act, responding to a feeling of incredible urgency to make sure it didn't go away. My family isn't especially prominent or noteworthy or influential. Our impact on this world is unlikely to come anywhere close to the legacy of someone like Nina Simone. But I felt a twinge of recognition when I read about the efforts to save her childhood home. I could relate to this desire to preserve something that, in the absence of any other tactile evidence, serves as a manifestation of histories not told anywhere else. My grandparents didn't mobilize migrant workers. They joined them season by season until they stopped so that my mother, their oldest child, could start first grade. My grandmother wasn't a cutting-edge fashion designer. She sewed and mended clothes to make and save money until her children grew up and left for college. My great-grandfather wasn't an architect or a designer. He built a four-room house out of stone that housed his family until he died. My ancestors weren't well-educated. Most of them couldn't read or write or speak English. They weren't rich or even middle class. Their stories aren't recorded in diaries or letters or the meeting minutes of private or public organizations. We do have some photographs, as you can see. And as my parents began working and pursued educations, as they assimilated into the middle class, archives were born. Love letters, home movies, notes from my dad's high school valedictorian speech. But before that, the history of my ancestors is embedded and preserved in functional objects, or woven into the stories told to children, which in their own way document the everyday lives of the everyday people that they were and are. In his farewell address to the nation, President Barack Obama reminded us that the Constitution is just a piece of parchment, paper that holds no power on its own, and that we as citizens give it meaning and power. It's funny to think about it that way, that this piece of paper means nothing without our validation. Of course, as archivists and librarians, this power to validate is part of our everyday work. From our collection development policies, to our standards and descriptive practices, to the procedures governing our reading rooms, every part of our practice offers legitimacy to our collections. And while I recognize that it's a long way from the US Constitution to the personal papers of a private individual, there is a connection there. Papers, records, print, or digital legitimize us, giving us the right to take up space on a shelf, and at an even more fundamental level, the right to be here in this country. And there's a clear and distinct difference between those of us who have papers to legitimize us and those of us who don't. The lack of family diaries are in no way equal to the consequences that arise from a lack of papers that grant a person citizenship, but I do think that these things exist on a continuum, along which the process of dehumanization gets a little bit easier. I have a lot of ideas for archives-themed t-shirts and tote bags and buttons, but if we're looking for a slogan or a word that really gets right to the point of what archives are about, I think context sums it up nicely. This is the concept that we teach our interns and students as they struggle to describe one folder among thousands in a collection. It's the concept we express to individuals and organizations whose papers and records we acquire, asking them to understand themselves as part of the larger historical narrative of their community, region, or nation. It's the concept that is essential to appraisal, allowing us to evaluate a collection's significance. In our descriptive practice, it's the concept that draws most deeply on our professional expertise, asking us not just to describe the contents of a collection, but explicate a collection's meaning through the multiplicity of relationships that exist within and around it. When I think about the very practical and reasonable question of how we can better account for stories that are untold, Context is the concept that I return to for answers. Our institutional holdings are frameworks for research and inquiry, a web of collections, small and large, that were acquired according to an appraisal process that is usually based on our institution's historical strengths, the interests and strengths of curators and administrators, and in response to the demands of established and emerging research. There are and will always be spaces in those frameworks where paths of inquiry end abruptly, connections fade, or threads come loose. Context asks us to address these gaps, which we generally do by recalibrating our collecting policies. In addition to relying on these conventional practices, we should also explore alternative approaches for collection development. One source of inspiration may be what Michelle Caswell, Jarrett Drake, and Doria Johnson termed micro-narratives. I understand micro-narratives to be the infinite stories that exist in a nebulous and often tumultuous space, offsetting the dominant historical narrative. As a counterpart to micro-narratives, we might support the creation and inclusion of micro-archives as a means of addressing gaps in documentation. Micro-archives might be an object, a single letter, a record, a photograph. They might be informal storytelling, snippets of memories, or words with alternative meanings. Or they might simply consist of a photo of a house that is contextualized by a story that is preserved alongside it with intentionality, not chance. They might find companionship among imaginary archives, another concept created by Michelle Caswell with her colleague Anne Gilliland that offers those without archives the ability to build archives through artistic processes. They could live within the realm of what Bethany Novisky calls speculative collections, a space that seeks to offer the power to create and the power of ownership. Whatever form they take, microarchives reveal and reinforce the relationships among records by amplifying the voices that exist in the shadows of our current holdings. Microarchives lay on top of and underneath traditional archives. They walk between the bulwarks of tradition. They expose themselves in glimmers and flickers like mirrors flashing in response to an erratic light. And like the micro-narratives that Caswell, Drake, and Johnson describe, they can allow individuals or communities to tell their own stories with complexity and nuance. Right, so, okay, I know. So first, I'll say, so what? I mean, coming up with strategies for managing digital archives hasn't exactly been easy for most of us, but we're trying anyway, because we know that we aren't doing our jobs if we ignore it. And if you think about the many methods of documentation that are embedded in most of our everyday lives, it doesn't seem so impractical. Technologies to create, record, and manipulate are more widely accessible than ever before, and the barrier for learning and using those technologies is considerably lower than it has been in the past. Social media, one of our contemporary culture's best documentary tools, could be particularly useful for assembling or creating microarchives. How many of us have makerspaces in our libraries? Why can't special collections be an extension of that space, a space that offers tools that we can use to gather, document, or build our histories? Special collections practice has a vital role to play in this new landscape of microarchives, imaginary archives, and speculative collections. Our expertise regarding appraisal, context, preservation, and access would be of incredible value here, value that currently is often under-recognized, even in our own institutions. Contributing to this new conception of archives would require a shift in the way that we think about our work, but there are many of us who are more than ready to make some fundamental changes to our practice, and this shift is long overdue. Many in our profession have already been advocating for this for decades. As practitioners, administrators, and ambassadors for special collections and archives, we have a responsibility towards action. There are a lot of us in this field, probably in this room, who are already doing outreach to marginalized communities, who are building partnerships with community-based practitioners, who are exploring and implementing post-custodial models for documentation. Yet the fact that these efforts exist primarily as projects or are channeled through one curator is an indication that institutions have yet to incorporate this work fully into the daily practice of every professional that intersects with special collections. These initiatives are remarkable models for what archives can be, They are a stable foundation to build upon, but we need to build with enough flexibility to respond to the intricacies of the histories we encounter, and in a way that is practical enough to undertake at a programmatic level. I'll admit I'm not exactly sure how to do that, but as I said, I have a lot of ideas, and though building an archive-themed tote bag empire sounds really fun, I'd rather collaborate with all of you to figure this out. Oral historian Daniel Kerr wrote an article published last year in the Oral History Review that discusses how radical practice has shaped oral history methodologies. Influenced by the ideas and methods of radical educators and activists like Miles Horton, Septima Clark, Ella Baker, and Stoughton and Alice Lind, the practice of oral history underwent a shift in the mid-20th century, where instead of explaining to people what the issues were that impacted their lives, those people were encouraged to engage in collective telling and listening, putting their individual experiences into the context of others' experiences, and using their dialogue as a lens to understand the structures of power. In this way, the historian acknowledged the shared authority embedded within the oral histories they had conducted. This helped to establish equality between the interviewer and the subject, and redefine the role of the oral historian, who is no longer seen as an authority, but as a catalyst for generating new knowledge. This approach empowered people to create and manage their own narratives according to their self-determined values, practices, and systems. I see potential for a parallel shift in archives and special collections, where we begin to see ourselves not as curators, but as catalysts for generating new understandings of history. Jay Satterfield, Director of Special Collections at Dartmouth, has spoken and written about the staff reorganization at his library that employs a distributed model for collection development. This model, which encourages all staff, including student employees, to contribute to collection development, has resulted in new acquisitions that may have been missed in the traditional curatorial model. In particular, he points to a diary that was purchased at the recommendation of a student intern, an item that the professional library staff had not been aware of. The leadership team at UC Irvine Special Collections is taking this model a step further. Audra Eagle Yoon, Tui Vo Dang, and Crystal Tribbett partnered with the Ethnic Studies Academic Departments at UCI to secure a grant to fund a research project that aims to bridge the gap between libraries and ethnic studies programs by engaging undergraduates in those departments in community-based archival work in a way that foregrounds students' lived experience. UCI's project calls to mind Salvador Guerena's history of the development of Chicano archives programs on university campuses, where he notes that many of those programs began as student-led efforts. These students worked to build collections that would support their desire to learn about their own community's history. The UCI project is intentionally designed to create a pathway into a career as an archivist, and I imagine that more than a few of the students at Dartmouth will be inspired to direct their career aspirations towards archives and special collections after working in that library. We need more models like these, particularly because they address two issues at once. They not only diversify our holdings in a way that invites new interpretations of archives and special collections to gain a foothold, they also have the potential to bring new audiences to special collections, and perhaps even inspire members of marginalized communities to join us in greater numbers. I'm trying to imagine what I would think archives are if I didn't yet know, or what my own microarchives might be like if I chose to create one. I have some ideas, and I know all of you do too. We are all the most proficient experts of our own histories. The most intimate knowledge of any community comes from the community itself. Every one of us should have the power to decide how our stories are represented. Every one of us should have the power to represent ourselves. Thank you.
Is this working? Yes. Okay, good. We have plenty of time for questions, it seems, at least 15 minutes. So Is there anyone out there who would like to begin? We've got that there. Okay, good. Now save me from asking the one I wrote down. As you said, as I said, I'm reluctant.
Of Virginia. That last talk, that totally inspired me, and you've probably already thought. I'm just going to hold it. you've probably already thought of this, but student social media pages are filled, are there micro archives, I guess? And I've been working on a personal project with social media for a few years. I have a collection of books built from social media, generated from social media, mostly published books. But I also, every time that a new product comes out that allows you to download your social media and produce a printed book, I buy it. And I make my own social media presence into the book. And the products are actually pretty cool. And there's a Facebook one that downloads your entire Facebook presence. And it produces this magnificent bound volume. And I was surprised at how great it was when I got it in the mail. And I know that this is converting from one form of media to another. And ideally, we could capture social media in its original format. But you've made me wonder whether at UVA we should offer to students that we want to buy a product. We want to buy a book of their social media feed. For instance, you can do these Instagram books that will create a book out of all your Instagram images. It does seem that this is a deeply photographic archive, since the students seem to tell their stories on social media almost all in photographs. But I somehow have this image of going to the, I don't know, Black Students Association or another community and saying, you know, would 20 or 30 of you be willing to download your social media into a book format and put them in the archives? And I just think it would be a really amazing thing to have as physical artifacts of the students' lives while they're at UVA, because you can download, say, a single year or 2 years of your presence, and a lot of that would be their time in school. So anyway, that's my idea, because you just inspired me to think of it. Thank you. Well, they've done that. They've curated their archive in Instagram for the most part. I mean, I use Facebook all the time. I don't think they do. But some of them do. But on Instagram or Tumblr, and they've curated an archive, a photo archive of their lives already. And that's a kind of micro archive, I guess.
Bowles Beinecke Library, thank you all for your presentations. This is kind of a sort of a thought question more than anything else. So the theme of the conference has been storytelling, and I love the storytelling and the narratives, but the really interesting thing about that is, as we expand the historical record with more and more stories, narratives, micro-histories, et cetera, it makes me think that if you're trying to do macro history, you know, the really big picture, it makes it more and more complex. And to me, it's sort of an interesting paradox. The more you supplement the historical record, the more you make it difficult, potentially, to construct a larger, so to speak, narrative, although I almost don't like to use that term because narrative and analysis sometimes conflict. So I'd be curious about any of your thoughts, if you've thought about that paradox in your own work or in working with scholars, in your collecting. Just curious.
I don't see it as a supplement of the historical narrative. And yeah, so I guess for me, the big picture narrative only becomes clear when you dig into the many threads of narrative. So it's only in doing that that I think I feel like I can get a sense of what the meaning of the historical record is. So it's in that process of using all of the available resources that you find that the answers to the big questions.
Can you hear me?
Oh. That's a really good question. I think I understand it correctly. One of the challenges at Rutgers, because we're such a massive organization, has been now that we have sort of sparked an interest and there are a lot of different groups of people who are doing their own histories and we're getting involved in a lot of projects, it's how do we preserve those stories? And so, you know, Scarlet and Black, we've got, you know, a book. But a lot of these projects are done by student organizations and, again, sort of capturing social media. I kind of am mostly worried about preserving all of the research that's been done and making sure that we have it and that we can make it available in a cohesive way. Like, that's sort of my concern now is documenting it, making sure we've got all of this work and this research in the archives. But that's a larger question about documenting a university with, you know, over 30,000 students, 15,000 faculty on three different campuses. So really sort of trying to capture it all is sort of my next challenge.
I guess I would just say I don't really understand why complexity equals difficulty. I mean, to me, I would think that it would make it more interesting and just give you more opportunities to explore different kinds of histories or different stories.
Okay, let's see. Greg Schmidt, Auburn University. I guess this one sort of goes to Lisa. My institution, as I mentioned, is in the Deep South, and with the movement of Confederate monuments in New Orleans and those sorts of issues in the foreground of the public discourse, it's made me think about like how Auburn has represented itself. Auburn is in Alabama, and when Alabama integrated its institution, we had George Wallace standing in the standing in the schoolroom door making a big stand. Very soon after, Auburn did it in a very understated manner so as not to make waves, but they accomplished it. We wait for renovations to move markers rather than moving them immediately. So we could be accused of being timid, or we could be accused of or we could be complimented for being politically astute, given our state and our funding. What do you think about that? It seems like we're missing an opportunity to invite discourse, to bring in these voices that are speaking on that and making a conversation at our university.
I'm very reluctant to opine about the politics in the South because it's just something that I don't have a lot of personal opinion with. So, but if you're, you know, you could see it as being thoughtful. You say you're being slow about addressing these, but there are plenty of opportunities to create that discourse, and I think it starts with just looking at one monument, one item, one building, and just unpacking a little bit of the history behind it, and even just putting that information out there, whether it's in the school newspaper or whether it's examining it in a class, as some of the Williams topics were examined through seminars. Or we had a couple of events where we basically just emailed the whole campus and said we're going to have an open forum to discuss cultural representation, and then people would show up and have very different ideas about what that meant, but they would show up with some idea about what they wanted to talk about. And Williams is a very small community, so it's a little bit easier, I think, to be effective within that community and feel like your voice can really be heard. But I was surprised at how quickly just talking and showing, showing some of the history and talking about it had a change on the community experience. One of the things that happened at Williams just recently is, until this past year, Martin Luther King Day was not a college holiday, and Columbus Day was still called Columbus Day, and it was a college holiday, and they flipped those two around this year, and I think it had a lot to do with these recent conversations about institutional history. So there is change that occurred much quicker than I thought it could, and it really was put into place by talking.
That we have this issue in Virginia, and the decision by our city council to remove a statue of Robert E. Lee has led to the Klan coming to visit us in July. So it's a very, very difficult situation for us. I also learned recently that at the University of Texas, they took down a Confederate statue. I can't remember who it was, but
Jefferson Davis,
thank you.
Okay,
yeah. Well, then I'll just sum it up really briefly as a compelling thing for people to leave with, imagining this as their situation. But the Center for American History was informed that it would grace their lobby. So it was moved from campus, where all the students had to walk by it every day, to the lobby of the center, their university archives and historical collections. And so that's I think just a really interesting fact, because I wasn't aware that had happened. So there's an example of how the move of objects through institutions can really have a profound impact. So, yeah.